Welcome to Trial and Medical Error, where we bridge the gap between medicine and law and unlock groundbreaking trial techniques. Join hosts Brendan Lupitin and Greg Uniton as they share novel insights and strategies to help you confidently tackle the most complicated cases. Produced and powered by LawPods.
In this episode, I talk with Jamie Anzalone and Kelly Ciravallo from the Anzalone Law Firm about a $3 million verdict they obtained on behalf of a 92-year-old woman who fractured her hip due to a fall and who died a couple of years later for unrelated purposes. So it's an interesting interview to find out how these two great trial lawyers obtained such a great verdict from what are arguably mundane facts. And in a case that would normally settle for $100,000, $150,000, they turned into this magnificent outcome. Kelly and Jamie talk about their approach to opening. What were the drivers to establishing liability, showing a pattern of conduct that got the jury ticked off, and a strategic move to set up punitive damages and a claim for punitive damages at trial, not beforehand. And then finally, their approach to a bifurcated punitive trial that led to a massive verdict against a nursing home group. So you'll get a lot out of this, especially for a nursing home practitioner, but just generally how to approach a case on behalf of somebody that on its face might not have the biggest damages. So enjoy the show. All right. So today, excited to talk to Jamie Anzalone and Kelly Ciravallo about an insane verdict that they got on a nursing home case that jumped out to me. I mean, I wasn't surprised to see your two names attached to the verdict when I read about it, but I was really kind of shocked at the size of this verdict when I read more about the specific facts of the underlying case. And I'm happy to have you both here to explain to myself and everybody else what the secret sauce was for this verdict. But you know, before we get into it, for those of you out there who don't know Jamie and Kelly, could you two, you know, maybe give us a little brief summary of your backgrounds? How did you become the star trial lawyers that you are today?
So we practice out of Luzerne County. We're in Wilkes-Barre. Our firm is Anzalone Law Offices. It was started by my dad back in the 90s, William Anzalone. He started with a pretty small group, just him and one other attorney, and I started practicing in 2006, and we've kind of slowly but surely built this great team made up of a mixture of family and excellent friends from law school. So right now it's six lawyers, and Kelly joined us, 8 years ago at this point. And Kelly and I were our cousins on my dad's side, and we'd always kind of, we didn't really hang out a lot growing up, but we would always keep in touch. And she would always say, hey, look, if there's ever an opening, I'd love to work with you guys kind of thing. And there was an opening 8 years ago. And we said, hey, why don't you come by? Maybe you could do some discovery. Maybe you could work from home. And that lasted like not even 30 days when we saw how great she was. And we just started going into complete light speed high gear. And here we are 10 years later. And we have a great team between myself, Kelly, Pat, who's a guy I went to law school with and played against high school football. And my sister's out in Colorado. She's one of our other partners. My dad still manages the firm. And we've picked up a couple other great lawyers, great auto and premises attorneys, Aaron Decker, Steve Kopko. And we've kind of just built this thing. We're hoping to take it to the next level. But yeah, that's a little background.
Awesome. Kelly, how about you? What's your vantage point? You agree with everything Jamie said or want to clarify?
All of it. No, I'm born and raised in the area. Like Jamie said, we're related, although in this area, almost everyone's related. But I got my practice in commercial litigation years ago. I've been practicing since 2005. And then I kind of not took a break, but was on my own for a little bit as I had some children and I trained and raced as a triathlete for a long time. And then this opportunity arose and Bill and Jamie asked me if I wanted to come on board and I was really excited. And yeah, as Jamie said, it was going to be drafting and writing and they kind of called it a mom job, which was ironic because about 2 weeks after I took the position, I found out I was pregnant with my third child. So actually, Jamie, I think it's going on 10 years because Bruno will be 9 in April. So
Right.
Yeah, that's how I gauged how long I've been on. I thought, oh my God, no, I'm having another baby. What are they going to say? They were so supportive and it didn't slow me down. It didn't slow us down. We've been cranking full steam ahead ever since day one.
So she took 4 days of maternity leave. So that's why it worked out really well.
That's awesome. Yep. So obviously, Kelly, Jamie was raised in, his dad founded the firm. And I imagine, Jamie, you were just kind of raised in the personal injury realm from Jump Street. Kelly, you started in commercial. What were your initial thoughts about the personal injury realm when you transitioned over? Did you have any big inclination to do it, or was it more just the family opportunity connection?
A little bit of both. I liked the idea of eventually doing trial work. The commercial stuff that I handled previously, I did do hearings and things like of that nature all across the state, Pittsburgh, Philly, locally. I was in a courtroom a lot. So when the opportunity came that I could potentially be, I knew I would be in the courtroom one day. Even if they said to me, we really need back end support, I knew that I could get myself in a courtroom and I knew that they would give me the opportunity. So I was really happy to make the transition.
Let me ask both of you, I know both of you are former and maybe still to some extent athletes, but both really high level, really good athletes. Do you feel that that applies or helps you as trial lawyers over time? And if so, what do you think the connections are between that background and then trial work now?
Well, I'll take it quick and then I'm going to pass it over to the much better athlete of the two of us. But so yeah, I played college football 4 years at Lafayette. Our other partner, Pat, played 4 years at Johns Hopkins. My sister has all the local diving records in our area and then played at Lafayette 4 years and dove and has the Patriot League records. Kelly's record, if you ever want to look at a novel's worth of accolades between the triathlons and marathons and just the competitive spirit of all. My dad played college football at Temple for 4 years back in the day. And when we go to our partners meetings, he runs them like a coach. And he actually says, now listen, we're all former athletes. I swear, it's like every single sentence he says, as athletic, competitive trial lawyers, this is what we need to do. So yes, I think it's very much a part of the fabric of our being. And from my perspective, it really, well, I hate to say this, but it kind of taught you how to lose and still get back and keep going at it. And you do lose, obviously. We always say that if someone says they don't lose a trial or got a crappy verdict, they don't try cases, right? So that has made us, I think, a very resilient group of lawyers in terms of not getting the verdict you want or losing. Each one of us have lost trials. I mean, we've had crappy verdicts and come back to work, keep grinding. And even in the ones where you have the upper hand, I think the athlete really prevails to say, I don't care how late I have to stay up. I don't care what I have to do. I'm getting this verdict. I'm here. I'm not going to fall short at the closing or whatever. So yes, I think it's very much a part of our encouragement and how we practice.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly, especially when it comes to resilience and endurance. I mean, trials are an endurance event, I think, and you need to be prepared to go the distance. And triathlon is a perfect analogy for a trial, I think, because all the work is on the back end. And then the race day comes and that's the day to show off, right? To show off all the work. Yet, you never know what's going to happen on that race day. You can get a flat tire. You can crash. I crashed at a world event when I was in China and I had to get up and decide, am I going to finish? I had people at home watching, or am I going to walk the bike in and call the day? No, I got up and finished. And you go to the med tent after the race, right? So like, you know how it is in trial, anything can happen. And this case that we're going to talk about is one of those cases where anything did happen, right? To our favor, obviously, but you never know. You got to be prepared for all those things. And I think triathlon is a perfect analogy for trial lawyer practice.
Oh, I love it. Yeah. Go ahead, Jamie.
Like Mike Tyson says, right? Everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face.
Yeah.
Right. And that's what happens at trial. You go in there, you have all the pomp and circumstance, you have your suit on, everything looks great. And then you get there and every single juror is bad. All right. Now what do you do? So I think sports really teaches you how to get through it.
Yeah, that reminds me of Rick Friedman wrote on Becoming a Trial Lawyer. He has this line where he's like, you do all this work, have this perfect symphony scripted on how the trial is going to go. And then basically the whistle gets blown and it turns into like a mud wrestling match right off the bat when everything's going different directions and all kinds of problems. You just have to fail through it. So everything that both of you just said, particularly about resilience and just that competition mindset resonates with me. So not surprising you both found your way into the courtroom with your backgrounds. So as Kelly alluded to, we're here to talk about this Brnavage. It's not Brnavage as some people have tried to pronounce it. So the estate of Brnavage versus Green Ridge Healthcare Group case, where you guys got this spectacular verdict. But and Kelly, you talked about how these kind of unusual, unforeseen things can happen in trial. But before we get into that, maybe I'm guessing probably some magic moments in your case with this outcome. But could one of you give us sort of an overview of what was the case about and why did it have to try? Why weren't you able to get this case resolved?
I think it's important to know the background and even the settlement posture of this case before you talk what the end result is. And it's kind of what makes the end result so beautiful. This was a case that, quite honestly, really was kind of just looked at. I hate to say this because someone fell and broke their hip, but just from the lawyering perspective, it really was a 92-year-old woman who was transferred and fell in the shower facility. I'll kind of talk about it broadly and then we can get like more detail, but who was being transferred from her wheelchair to a shower chair. The nurse who was the CNA who was transferring her slipped and fell on some water that condensed and built up on the tile. She fell down and took our client with her, and they kind of landed together, and our client fractured her hip and had surgery 5 days worth in the hospital, and then died 2 years later from unrelated causes. She was on hospice when she fell. For better or worse, that's kind of how we looked at it, that it was just, that's what the case was. It was a negligent case. I didn't really think much on the punitive of it. We do a lot of nursing home work, and that case has a range somewhere between 100 to 350-ish. They're tough cases, right? I mean, she had multiple comorbidities. She had dementia. She had on hospice. She had osteoporosis. She had everything you could have when you're 90. So we went to a mediation. I think our demand was maybe $300,000. And the best they offered was $120,000. And my client said, and our client is, so the estate's represented by her one and only daughter. Her name is Carolyn Benson, real estate agent, very tough negotiator, like was never doing this at all for money. Just wanted to prove the point that I know people fall all the time. I know this happens. I know it gets swept under the rug. That's why I'm doing it. But in any event, so we were at the mediation and she said, I'll take $150,000, but not a penny less. I mean it, nothing less than that. And we respected that. And they offered $120,000. They said, well, too bad. No settlement. So fast forward, I said, and quite frankly, her and I had a little heated debate on, does this really make sense to keep going forward? She's very tough. She said, I don't care. I'm certifying this for trial. You will not be happy unless we go to trial, and I'm not going to feel good about it. Let's just get it ready for trial. So fast forward a year, going into it, and our judge, Judge Mullen, who's a wonderful trial judge, very good at getting cases settled and really kind of banging heads together, says, okay, Jamie, where is your settlement demand now? And my client was so aggravated by the way Sabre Healthcare, and that's who's running this case, by the way, Sabre, and they're essentially self-insured. They have a chief legal counsel who does all their negotiating. She told me, I said, look, we're going into our settlement conference. Trial is next week, 2 weeks from now. Where are we at on the demand? Are we still at 150? She said, 225, not a penny less. Are you kidding me? This judge is going to kill me. She goes, I don't care. I'm not, that's it. I said, well, okay, well, fine. I mean, at this point now, I was starting to read through the deposition transcripts, talking to Kelly. I'm like, there's some highlights here. I think we may be able to do something with this that's even better than what the client wants. So I was happy kind of for her to say 225. So we go into the settlement conference with the judge. She was furious with us. I said, Judge, I have never had a client this staunch on the number. You can talk to her, we're blue in the face. It's trying. There will not be movement. And Sabre, they would, of course, you know how hard, I mean, I don't know if you ever dealt with them, Brendan, they are as hard-headed as it gets. Their mantra is to try everything. I mean, really, and then offer crap. Well, anyway, they didn't offer anything more than 130. And the judge said, well, is there something you guys can do? And I said to them, look, I don't have authority for this, but maybe we can split the difference between 225 and 130. And maybe you guys could, I don't know, change a policy, do something equitable, something that will make her feel good about it, because it really isn't about the money. And the woman that they sent to us for the settlement conference looked me right in the face with Kelly there and said, she had a Russian accent. She was Eastern European. She goes, "This is not an auction. It's a negotiation. We don't value your claim." Just like that. And if, like, you know, being an athlete, like you're saying, like, what do you need to get pumped up to try a case?
Ivan Drago, on the other hand.
I said, "Kelly, this is, we're done. We're gone. Good night. No more talking." I went out to our client. I go, "Good for you for staying at 225. We're ready to go now." So then we try it, and then we start the case, and literally we would have taken 225, and then I don't know how much you want to get into the case, but throughout the case, they were going to offer 300. Then we asked them to tender to MCARE. They wouldn't do that. And then we'll talk about how we ended up getting to the trial. But
yeah,
this could have been done for $150,000 at the mediation 2 years ago.
Well, isn't that the best to remind the other side about?
It's the best. And now they're looking at a $3 million verdict with interest building as we speak.
So, Kelly, how did the two of you, you got a motivated client. You guys are now motivated because of there's now this opponent on the other side. How did you guys divvy up who did what during the trial? And also, how did you approach sort of your strategy of trial? What were you going to focus on? And not to give you like a 10-part question here, but I'd love it if you two could share any of your sort of trial influences, any of the books that have resonated with you, any seminars or so forth. Jamie, I know you have talked about takeaways from this that can be applied to other cases, but how did you guys go into this with the 9 parts of that question I just threw at you?
So the way we broke it up, so first we have to talk about, we're talking about the initial trial, because
That's right. Don't forget,
and I'm into this, we tried 2 trials in this case. So the first trial, what was it, in April, Jamie? I focused on damages and Jamie focused on liability. And because as he was reading the depositions of the nurses and everything, he started getting this inkling like he was going to kind of go for it, see if we can get recklessness. I had to focus on the damages, which was somewhat difficult because we're talking about an elderly woman, like Jamie said, all these comorbidities. But I was lucky enough to have a great expert who went back and looked at like the range of x-rays and things like that of this woman's hip and was able to establish that not only did she have the fall, the surgery, but she had a resulting like pin migration. So he was able to, and we hammered this for about what, Jamie, 2 hours on the stand, I think, how for 2 years till she passed away from unrelated causes, she had constant pain every time she moved. And she was on a turning and repositioning schedule every 2 hours. So every 2 hours, that pin was pushing into her hip. So I had an excellent expert on that. I handled that portion. And then the client was excellent too. At first, I thought it was going to be a little rough going. Like Jamie said, she was kind of standoffish, but she had the perspective of having her mom in this facility when it was privately owned. And then Sabre took over the facility, and I was able to get her to testify without objection as to that transition and how things went downhill. And she gave some great testimony comparing and contrasting when it was privately owned. It was like home. It was comfortable, like the bedspreads and curtains matched, and she loved her mom being there. And then Sabre took it over, and she got in a lot of testimony about everything falling apart at the facility. So I handled that portion. And then Jamie really hammered the liability, and he'll have to tell you how that played out on the stand, because it was actually kind of dramatic.
Yeah. Okay. So yes, I want to hear that Jamie liability. Who did opening?
Oh, I did the opening.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you have a particular way? Does your firm have a particular way you structure your openings? Like, do you follow the ball type format with the rule? Or is it more case by case? Or what do you do in regard to your typical opening statement?
So this opening statement was all rule-based. And I kind of got away with a lot, I think, in the opening, because I focused on the nature of nursing homes as being a whole kind of community where there are federal and state rules regarding every aspect of that nursing home operation, right? I mean, there are federal rules regarding you know, temperature of meals served and stuff like that. So I talked about how Sabre owned 150 nursing homes. Owning an entity owning that many nursing homes is required to know all the rules, to follow all the rules, and like to implement. And when they break the rules, here are the things that can happen, right? Not just someone falling, someone could die, someone could hit their head, there's medication errors, that kind of thing. So I hammered not just the rules pertinent to this particular incident, I hammered the fact that there are rules governing everything and that the facilities have to follow all of them or there can be catastrophic consequences. And it was maybe a little redundant now that I look back on it, but I think it's an easy way to open in a nursing home case, right? Because they are so heavily regulated.
Gotcha.
What I really liked about Kelly's opening, and so when we were looking at this case, we do a lot of bed sore work. And in those cases, the damages, they speak for themselves. They're so grotesque. I mean, anybody wants to be sick when they see them. But fractured hip cases, I mean, even as a country, I think we've become so numb to that. Oh, 90-year-old fractured her hip. Happens every day. Where's the damage in that? So we kind of, Kelly and I, when we were looking at the opening, we said, look, let's think about all the nursing home work we do. And why do people get bed sores? Why do people fall out of bed? Why do people fall when they get transferred in the nursing facility? Why do the medication errors happen? It's because someone's breaking rules. And why are the rules there? To keep all of us safe, keep our grandparents safe, our uncles, our aunts. And in nursing homes, that's a community of rules that if they're not followed, just like out on the road, if they're not followed, people get hurt. So, and you can do that in nursing. And so what we tried to say was almost put everything out there and talk about all the other bad cases, worse than ours, bed sores, brain injuries, falls, all things we've handled, and try to make it a little bit more than just a hip fracture case. And Kelly did a great job with that. And by basically saying that this is a community that's governed by rules, they have their own little protocols. And when they're not followed, people die. People get bed sores. People have fractured hips. And then that's kind of how she tailored it and then put it back into this case.
One thing I wanted to emphasize is we all know of nursing homes and people that are in them. But really, when you put a loved one in a nursing home, it is supposed to be their home. They're not really there to just go and get like some nursing care or whatever, right? They have meals there. They have guests there, visitors. That is their home for all intents and purposes, right? And we sometimes forget that. It gets kind of lost in the shuffle. We just look at it as a generic facility. And I didn't want it to look like that to the jury. And I wanted to kind of set the tone like this could be our loved ones too, to make it a little bit more personal.
What were the primary defenses, and especially the ones that you had to address in opening and try to undermine or put in context?
Well, one thing we probably should tell you, what made it good about why the case was good as a rule case is Sabre did not have a grab bar on the tub that they were transferring our client. So real quick, let me just, how this transfer happened. The CNA came in and brought our client, who was actually supposed to be an assistive two with all transfers, and they didn't update her care plan. So, but at a minimum, she was an extensive assistive one, okay? And as in the nursing home world, if you're an extensive assistive one, the patient who transferred can't bear weight on their own at all. So if you're going to have them lean on something, you need to be hands on them and make sure that if they fall one way or the other, you're kind of there for them. So she transferred our client from the shower chair, or sorry, from the wheelchair, and she was going to transfer her to the shower chair. But while she did that, rather than grab her and put the two chairs next to each other and have our client hold on to her neck, the nurse is supposed to hold on to the waist. They stand together, they pivot, and you put her down into the chair. That's minimal standing. That's no weight bearing. That's the safest way to do it. Well, what she did was she stood her up and had her stand with her hands on the lip of a very large tub that was in that area. That tub was kind of being used for that purpose for all these residents and without a grab bar. It's just a lip of a tub. And they should have had a grab bar per the PA's code. If they were going to use that to transfer patients, you need a grab bar there for them to actually help hold their weight a little bit. So that's kind of that was our big rule, was that they didn't know how to put a grab bar. That they didn't put a grab bar in, which could have taken literally all of 30 seconds, and maybe this incident would have been completely avoided.
But they didn't really have any defenses to liability other than to say it was just an accident. And as to the grab,
sorry, I forgot the question.
Yeah.
No, it's a good setup.
They didn't have an expert as to liability, whereas we had an excellent expert. And they just kind of said it was a mistake. No one really meant for this to happen. And as far as the grab bar not being there, well, I think they kind of took the position that they weren't really required to have it there because they weren't using that area to shower the resident, right? But again, as Jamie said, it was this wide lip, probably like 5 inches or so, maybe more. You could never grab it, right? This poor woman was just kind of placing her hands on it. So there would have been no ability to use it to grab if you're falling. And they maintained the position that that wasn't really the intent of the code to have a grab bar there because they weren't actually using that area to shower the residents.
You know, and they kind of took a common sense defense on it. They didn't use an expert, which was strange. In fact, they had an expert who was going to handle liability and damages. And then they said, we're not going to use him on liability because I think they knew that they would have gotten it thrown out. He wasn't the proper expert for it. And I think their defense was just a common sense one, which was to say, this CNA never had hands off of this client. She was extensively assisting her with one. She was supporting her. She had her hands on the lip of the tub. She had her hand on her back the whole time. And unfortunately, the CNA slipped on the slippery floor. That's why it happened. Not because our lady was dropped or because our lady lost her balance. She slipped and fell. And so they took this kind of very common sense approach that she was doing her best. The world needs people like this CNA. Without CNAs like this, people don't have anyone to care for them. That was kind of more of the defense. And then their damages defense, of course, was she was on hospice. You were going to potentially die within 6 months. She wasn't moving at all before. She had dementia. And they actually had an expert who got on the stand who said that looking at all of her pain meds, after her fractured hip, she was back to baseline within about, 45 or 50 days. And that's kind of how they tried to limit the damages.
Got it. So on the liability part, I'm curious, wasn't it supposed to be a two-person assist and there was only one?
They disputed that because it was the nursing supervisor who did the evaluation herself. They're all like bullet point things that they fill out on the electronic chart. She puts assist of two required in two spots on the chart about 3 weeks before the fall.
Sure.
And then they just said, I must have made a mistake because everywhere else in her chart, it said assist of one. But it was hard for her to run from that on the stand. I mean, she's clearly marked assist of two. And then we said that you didn't update the care plan because of that. So that was the easiest liability to say. You could say you did the best job you wanted. You needed two people.
Right.
And so there's liability there. But then we said, even if she's an extensive assist of one, we'll give you the benefit of the doubt. You still transferred her incorrectly. And then that's how we can get into this reckless testimony here, whenever you'd like.
Well, I want to get into your discussion of liability, but two big questions before. And one, this, I could see on the one hand that the Saber would try to portray the CNA as this was just an accident. She slipped. This was just a freak out. It had nothing to do with any of these, you know, policy or rule violations. I mean, and I could see a risk of the CNA, depending on how you played it, being sort of a sympathetic entity, right? So how did you handle her? I imagine she had to testify at some point. Did you call in your case in chief or was she called in the defense case?
No, case in chief, as of cross.
And how did you handle it?
Wasn't she our first witness?
I think she was, and she's a very sympathetic witness.
Yeah. She was wonderful, but probably to her disfavor, she didn't fight very much. And I think that's kind of what we see a little bit in some of the nursing home cases where, especially in the trial setting, the CNAs are not doctors. They don't have the confidence level. They don't have the schooling level. Their inclination really is not to fight every single question and try to prove they're smarter than the lawyer. They're nervous up there. So there was a couple of things in her deposition that when I looked at it, I'm like, I probably could have pressed harder on this area of questioning, because in her deposition, she admitted that the way I had her positioned, that if she was to fall to the left or to the right, I couldn't catch her because of the way I had her positioned. So I said, let's fret this out more. Like I said to Kelly, I'm like, I think we can try to go for this and maybe we can really get her to admit some bad stuff here. So And the way I set it up was, you know what the jury instruction is on reckless indifference, right? Like conscious decision, knowing something bad could happen, doing it anyway. So in my head, I'm like, well, if we could get her to admit that I could not catch this woman if she fell to the left or to the right based on the way I transferred her, essentially you gambled. So the way I set it up was, I said, okay, you agree that the safest way to transfer somebody, well, I know here's the first way we said it was, I said, you know, the chart now says assist of two required. Would you have liked to know that two people were needed for this transfer? And she says, yes. Right. So that's the easiest way to put it on the administration. Like, they put her on an island. I said, and clearly you only had you. And if the chart says she's supposed to be assisted by two, then that's wrong. Right. Like, you were on an island, you'd be on your own. You should have been told. Yes, I would have liked to have been told. So that was our easiest liability. But then, just in case the jury thought that the assist of two was an error, very well could have been, I really don't know. I said, okay, let's just assume now she's not an assist of two, she's extensive assist of one. You agree the safest way to transfer somebody like her is to do this pivot maneuver that we just talked about earlier, where she puts her arms around your neck, you go around their waist, you literally pick her up, pivot, and place her down. That's the safest way to do it. I agree. And fair to say, you did not do that. No, I did not. Let's talk about how you did do it. You took her out of the wheelchair. You had her place her hands on the lip of the tub. Yes. Now, as you're doing that, you're trying to now grab the shower chair. Right. So as that's happening, you agree that if she falls to her left or she falls to her right, because of the way you're doing this, you are not in a position to catch her or break her fall. No, I am not. But you chose to do that, knowing that the safer way to do it was the pivot method. That's right. And you did it anyway. And in fact, you had done this multiple times with this patient, and lucky enough, she didn't fall. Right. So fair to say you gambled all the other times that she didn't fall. And this time the gamble didn't pay off. Right. You made a conscious choice to do it this way as opposed to the safer way. Yes. Knowing that if she fell left or right, you couldn't catch her. Yes. Do you agree that is a reckless decision? Yes. No objection. So, like, you know, when you're Brandon, you ask that question, you're like, please come on, give it to me. Yes. Like, all the bells go off.
Yeah.
And so then it was after that, they couldn't rehab. I mean, they rehabbed her, of course, but it wasn't good at that point. So that's how that was the first area of establishing reckless conduct. And even if she didn't admit she was reckless, I think we still basically went through the jury instruction with her and we would have gotten a reckless indifference charge. But that's how it first happened. And then after that, we had the nursing supervisor who was called up next. We just went through the same exact. I said, you heard everything she said. You know that people had been transferred the way she was talking about the way the transfer happened. No, there was no grab bar. You guys continue to let it go on. You knew about it. Nothing changed. Do you agree that it was reckless for the administration to allow that to occur? They did object to that, but it was sustained. It was overruled because it had already been all admitted to before.
Yeah. Can I just add that the nursing administrator was speaking on behalf of Sabre?
Right.
So she was binding, her answers were binding as to Sabre. And there was additional evidence that this shower facility had been slippery and hazardous previously, that Jamie was able to elicit that testimony as well. The nursing staff had complained to her as the nursing administrator. So then Sabre had notice of this slippery condition in the facility. They didn't provide anything to remediate that. They didn't provide squeegees, grab bars. They didn't provide towels. They didn't provide mops, any of that. And she admitted all those things as to Sabre. So there was not only the reckless conduct of the individual nurse, there were these great admissions on the stand of the recklessness of Sabre by and through the nursing administrator.
And that's what I was wondering when, Jamie, you were talking about picking up all this great reckless testimony from this individual. What was the connection? So you showed that through the nurse manager, the head nurse, that they knew that this was a problem to some extent. And now you're imparting that on Sabre, the corporate entity. Did you specifically try to lay out the, quote, system failures, that there was a lack of training, there's a lack of response, or what did you try to focus in to really make the connection of a system failure, recklessness on the part of Sabre versus the individual HALO-type certified nurse assistant?
I don't think we didn't really change. So our theory of the case always was there was a reckless or negligent, careless transfer. And that Saber knew that people were being transferred that way in that facility, knowing it was wet, knowing they didn't have proper equipment, knowing there was no grappler. So we kept it very confined to that and not making it an entire systemic failure with lack of training, lack of staffing, lack of all that, because we really didn't have that evidence. But what we did have was clear testimony from this nursing supervisor, who was kind of a liaison between the nurses, nursing staff, and the administration, that we were getting complaints by the CNAs saying, it's wet in there. We're going to fall. Our patients are going to fall, right? So we were able to show that, look, despite repeated issues that people were having and worried about their own safety, that's CNAs, you knew patients were being transferred the same way this patient was being transferred. You knew there was no grab bar, and you let it happen. It was just kind of like a classic pattern of conduct thing. And while nobody fell, right, and that was their big thing, she's like, well, nobody fell. I said to the nursing home administrator, I'm like, well, if you do something wrong 100 times and the 101st time someone gets hurt, it doesn't make the past 100 right. Just as an accident waiting to happen. So it was very simple. And I think we didn't go crazy on the other stuff.
No, and I should add here too, maybe this is a good point to bring this up. We didn't originally allege recklessness. And so all the questions that Jamie was asking of both the CNA and the nurse administrator to kind of establish this now at trial related to facts as alleged in our complaint. So we never alleged this grand corporate negligence claim based on policies and procedures because we didn't really have that. As Jamie said, originally this case was your garden variety slip and fall hip fracture in a nursing home. So Jamie asked questions related to the state of mind, the knowledge, the consciousness on the stand as it related to the facts already pleaded in our complaint. So that's why then after these great admissions, we then rested and I got to say, I'm like, Jamie, we have to ask for a directed verdict. I said negligence and recklessness. And because I'm kind of aggressive that way. But I knew if we did that, then we were likely to get leave to amend the pleadings and all that, which we then had to do. And that kind of set up the whole, you know, going into the verdict and the charges we got and things like that.
Right. So after that, we asked for a directed verdict on recklessness. You're right, on reckless indifference. And yeah, the judge took a day or so. While I'm denying that, which obviously she should have,
yeah,
I will allow you to amend your complaint to add punitives, which we did before we went to verdict.
So let me jump in there for a second. Strategically, is that something that you always do? Because it seems to me like it worked in your favor a lot, that it kind of sounds like you caught the defense off guard a bit, because there wasn't this big corporate reckless claim in the pleadings going into trial. But here you have this sense that you can get it, you get it, and then you're able to amend to get the punitives after the fact. I mean, do you think strategically that played to your favor going that route?
In this case, yes. I would never really like to gamble this way like that.
No,
I would prefer
it. Because it seemed like it worked out so perfectly for you.
There's a couple of gambles in this case that worked out that I wonder if we should do them again, but I'll let Kelly talk about it.
Yeah, I'm not so sure. I mean, I like to amend the pleadings early enough to maybe get network discovery, that kind of thing, going into the trial. That would be how I would typically handle this. But in this case, Brendan, you hit the nail on the head. They were totally caught off guard. And in fact, that was counsel's biggest objection when we asked for leave to amend our complaint to add punitives. He said, this was just a negligence case. I didn't prepare it like it was a punitive case. And I kind of thought, like, so what? That's on you. Anything at any point in time, someone could testify saying they made a conscious decision. Or that was their biggest objection when we were given leave to amend to include punitives. And they didn't really have a leg to stand on at that point. I mean,
you had the testimony.
Yeah.
Unobjected to testimony. One objection. All those questions. So they were definitely caught off guard.
And that's exactly right, Brent. I mean, as now we look back on it, you say, how did you get them to admit this and that? And how did you get this punitive? Because they were absolutely sleeping. They basically thought this was a 90-year-old who fell in a shower. It's a negligence case. Maybe it's a $150,000 verdict. Done. And that's how it was prepared. Those nurses were not prepared correctly. CNA was not prepared correctly because they just never thought it would go to this level. But that's the beautiful part about trial is anything can happen, right? And just because you testify to one thing in a depth doesn't mean the lawyer can't get you to do something different on the stand. And I agree with Kelly. I probably would never go into a punitive case without the complaint being amended and having all of our ducks in a row. But when you look back on one like this, maybe it's something that's not crazily strong during discovery and you just kind of go into the trial and see what you can get and then you amend.
So my feeling is I kind of lean more towards what you two did at trial insofar as, don't you find when you're taking depositions, if you start asking the reckless questions, even though Lackawanna County has some of the best opinions out there about you can't object anymore and you can't have all these speaking and blocking objections, they're still going to do stuff and act in a way and block you in deposition. I always find at trial, and now they're worried about, well, I don't want to seem like I'm being irrational and problematic in front of this jury or this judge. And so I think, and it's not even getting away, it's just that you have greater freedom to ask those questions at trial, I think, than you do in deposition. I think this is a perfect example that I would more frequently lean towards doing what you did. And I'll just deal with the fact that I don't have the, you know, the net worth stuff after the fact. Rather get that reckless charge first.
Well, I mean, it worked out beautifully in this case, honestly. I don't know.
What it probably lends, though, to is if you take it easy in discovery, you don't go after all the recklessness, you're going to try more cases because you're not going to have built up a crazy punitive claim that's going to lead to settlement. You're going to get it at trial.
No doubt.
But whatever. I mean, it's about this case is that you can go into our next case and say, look what happened in that case.
Well, exactly.
We're going to get reckless.
Exactly.
Right? I think that's the better lesson and takeaway.
So we talked about the two nurses. Things have gone swimmingly as far as the testimony that you've gathered. What's the rest of your case in chief? What do you face in their case? And are there any other sort of like turning moments or key moments in that trial that lead to your outcome? Or was it over at that point?
It was kind of over at that point.
I'd say the liability was certainly over at that point.
Well, Jamie, even as far as their damages expert was terrible. And Jamie did the cross of their damages expert. And we had the benefit of having his testimony in the can before we put on our case in chief. So I was able to then rebut everything in our case in chief with our expert. But Jamie, just for a moment, address how ridiculous their damages expert was.
Oh, they had a repeat customer. You've definitely heard his name if you do nursing home work. His name is Bruce Silver. He's a doc out of California now. He practiced in PA, but he hasn't lived here since 2014. So Burns White, who does the defense in this case, they do so much long-term care work in our area. They're starting to lose a little bit of it now, but they do a lot of it. And they use this Bruce Silver. Every case I've ever had against him is Silver's on the other side. But I never got to depose him because the settlement rate on nursing home cases is high. High before you even get to pre-trial or anything like that. So I had gotten some transcripts on it, but nothing that was great other than just to show that this is Burns White's guy, right? So he comes and he's very elitist in his presentation. He's testifying from California. He hasn't stepped foot in a PA nursing home since 2014. And I think in nursing home work, I think jurors want to know that the experts you're using are on the grounds and they're in the battlefield dealing with 90-year-old patients all the time. So he's there from California. He's zoomed in and he has this nice bow tie on and he's very standoffish. And I go, now I know that you testify for Burns White because I have another trial coming up in a few weeks where you're the expert, same firm. I says, how many times do you think you've testified for Burns White? Oh, I don't know. Since been doing it since before the turn of the century. That was the best line for us. He said, so I don't know. Couldn't tell you. I call this the Neil O'Donnell way of stepping up to ridiculous numbers. I said, okay, doctor. I mean, what do you think? You think you testified more than 10 times for them? Oh, it's got to be more than 10. How about more than 20? Sure, it's more than 20. This is reports and testifying. How about more than 30? Yeah, for sure. More than 40. And I took that number all the way up to 100. How about 60? Yeah, it must be 70 to 100. And I go, how about we set the ceiling? What's a number you definitely cannot go over in this answer? He goes, well, I'll bet I haven't testified for them more than 30,000 times.
Awesome.
I said, obviously you're joking, but how did you possibly come to that number? And then he kept going. He's like, well, I figure that if I was testifying for them 24 hours a day over the course of 60 years, that probably amounts to 30,000. And I know it's not that. I go, okay, so it's somewhere between 250 reports and 30,000. And that was it. Usually, some of that stuff I think jurors don't care about. This was profound. I mean, it was a joke. He was like essentially in the payroll for Burnsworth. That was the funny part. And his testimony was absurd to say that this poor lady has a hip fracture with a pin migrating through. And he says she's recovered back to baseline in 55 days. And he like set this hard deadline. And I think that pissed people off.
That's very reminiscent of like those arguments in the disc injury cases where they're like, well, I would expect 2 months of pain and suffering. And then it's mm-hmm. over at that point. And everything else after that is unrelated and degenerative disc yep. disease and so forth.
Yeah, it was kind of the same exact playbook.
Coincidence. So the case, I assume the two of you are just kind of feeling like everything is, it's really hitting on all cylinders. You kind of have those trials where it's just, everything's kind of going your way. Were there any moments where you felt like worried or concerned or anything like that? Or was it pretty smooth sailing all the way through closing?
I think it was smooth sailing all through closing from jury selection to closing. Don't you, Jamie?
Yeah. No, well, I'll tell you what. So Judge Munley, if you've ever tried a case runner, she's great. She has such a great personality. And she's old school, though. Like, she's like, if something's going the plaintiff's way or the defendant's way, she will tell you, go talk. And then she said, go start talking, right? She'll yell at you. But it's awesome. Like, it just reminds you of, like, stories my dad would tell me about her dad, who was a judge, who was the same way, who just he had such a good sense of what was going on in the courtroom. So she says to Saber, right after the reckless testimony, she goes, you better start talking, right? So we said to them, I mean, throughout the case, we're like, well, the 300 is now off the table. I mean, we're not there anymore. I said, why don't you tender to MCARE? That seems simple enough. It's 500 of your own money. They'll kick in the five because of the way this case is going. You're done. You've costed 500 of your own money. And they said, no, the most we'll offer you is kind of where your original demand was of 225. We felt at least that we didn't have to worry about turning anything down. It's not like they came in and said, all right, here's 400 or 500. Maybe we'd have to have some guts to turn that down. But luckily, we never got put in that position. They made it easy for us. So yeah, going into closing was solid. We got reckless indifference charge. And then she charged on direct corporate recklessness as well as the vicarious MCARE reckless charge, where you'd have to show that they knew about the conduct that was occurring from the CNA. So we got to charge both of those.
So tell me how that shakes out. Did you have to do a separate closing for punitives, or was it all in one? And was the verdict compensatory and punitives, or was there like bifurcation, or how did that all shake out?
Well, before she charged the jury, I think it was, if I'm not mistaken, we argued that if they're getting the reckless charge, we wanted to close then immediately on the punitives, and we would forego net worth discovery and we could make our arguments. And we wanted this panel to hear and decide if they came back with recklessness, a finding of recklessness, we wanted them to come back and decide punitives. Well, the defendants objected strenuously to that. They did not want it to go to the same panel. They wanted the whole thing to be bifurcated. And so that's what ended up happening. So the jury came back in maybe like an hour with a compensatory award of 300 and a finding of recklessness as to corporate and vicarious. So our thinking at the time was, well, we have all this energy built up, and they heard the witnesses on the stand themselves testify as to the reckless conduct. Like, so if we were to bifurcate that and come back, how do you kind of recreate that energy? And I really argued close on punitives right then and there. But in hindsight, I think it worked out to our benefit to bifurcate. So the judge, after they came back with the verdict, that was that. She directed that a new jury would be impaneled, and she gave us some time to do net worth discovery. The defendants wanted the ability to do net worth discovery, because I think they were going to take the position, and they did take the position consistently throughout discovery and trial, that they have no money to pay punitive damages. Jamie can get into this a little bit more, but we spent the summer then, probably like 3 months, because our trial got moved, serving discovery and taking depositions of Saber corporate people to establish the net worth. And then our second trial, which was 4 days, was solely on the issue of whether and how much Sabre should pay in punitive damages. So that's kind of like a broad stroke.
Well, on that part, so you have to do a whole second trial on punitives. You said whether and how much. If recklessness was already decided, how is it not just how much?
Because that's the instruction. There can be recklessness, but not necessarily an award of punitive damages. The jury was tasked with deciding whether punitive damages were warranted, and if so, how much. We argued against that. We took the position that it was just a how much deal, but it really, if we're being honest, it really isn't written like that. And it is whether and how much.
Okay.
Yeah, the jury instruction on punitives, it's 8.0. It says, if you find the conduct of the defendant was outrageous, which is defined as reckless indifference, you may award punitive damages. So the second trial was, should punitive damages be awarded? You don't have to find reckless indifference. The jury, first jury already found that. You're into the next phase. Reckless indifference is done. Do you think this reckless indifference or this act deserves punitive damages? And if so, how much?
Okay. So for this second trial, I mean, for those of us that have never tried a bifurcated punitives, I have not.
It was our first go around as well.
Did you have to give an opening and then put testimony on and then give another closing again?
Yes, sir.
So yes, we did. But Judge Munley made it a little bit easier for us. So preparing over the summer, we did our due diligence. We hired a financial expert, great expert, which guided us along the way with what kind of information we needed, the corporate documentation that we needed, helped with taking the depositions of the CFO. So that was one whole aspect. But then so that's as to the financial net worth of the defendants, but you still have the conduct in there too, right? To show how egregious the conduct was. So Jamie and I kept talking all summer, like, do we call the witnesses? How do they testify? The defendants shouldn't be allowed to call their witnesses again to kind of soften the blow, right? Well, Judge Munley stepped in and entered an order saying we were only allowed to have the witnesses come in and stick to their original testimony. So what we essentially did is had called the witnesses and they read in their transcript.
Oh, wow. That is bizarre.
So bizarre. Again, because we had never done this before. I mean, we've had situations where you win reckless indifference and you just try to argue punitives right then and there, or better, even if the bifurcation happens, any normal defendant would say, oh God, we're about to go into a second trial where all they have to do is punish us, settle. Right? And the judge had like three settlement conferences. And Sabre, if you've ever dealt with them, they are very difficult. They don't care. I mean, they have a lot of money. They move it very well. And the reason they wanted to bifurcate it, not looking back on it, and I don't know if the defense lawyer knew this or not, but he probably had this instruction, make sure you bifurcate. What they didn't want was the jury to think that Sabre was just this multi-billion-dollar company without having their documents and get some crazy punitive award in the first trial. So they argued for it to be bifurcated. And then the judge said, well, I'm going to bifurcate it. I'm letting you do punitive damage discovery all summer, which we did. And thank God we had a great forensic team, because the way Sabre Healthcare Group, and they manage 150 nursing homes, they are set up to break even or lose. They make over $50 million a year, but all the money is moved around. They pay money to a management company, which is made up of their CEO, by the way, and their chief investment officer. So they're paying lots of money up top there. So the money's still staying in-house, but it's looked at as a loss, as an expense. Then they pay money back to the facilities, and then they have sweep accounts, and they have all this stuff. They're a very large, very lucrative company, but they wanted to engage in this discovery to show us that, look, we don't have money. We're just a management group. So that we spent a lot of time over the summer and a lot of money, right, on this case that these costs never should have been like this. We thought this was a run-of-the-mill case. So much money on it. We actually had, because Kelly and I do not, I mean, look at, we run a nice business here, but we're not accountant experts by any means. We couldn't make heads or tails on these financial documents. So we actually paid our experts to sit in during our CFO depositions. And then we took the CEO's deposition of the company and the chief legal officer to say, look, if there's anything that these guys are that we're blatantly missing or they're misrepresenting, you need to let us know. So that cost a lot of money. But at the end of the day, when we went into the trial, we were able to figure out, here's how they're moving money. And here's how we can show the jury, if you come up with an award, don't believe them that they don't have money. Here's three, we were able to show like three or four different buckets where they can pull the money from.
That's an important point. We were never able to establish the net worth of this company. That was just never going to happen because the financials that they gave us did show like they were break even or whatever. But the financial expert that we had was worth the money that we paid them because they were able to help us tease out, okay, on paper, they look like they don't make money, but here are all the other entities above this entity. The income's going up. It's all the same people. And here are all these areas where they have pockets of money that are available to pay. So we could never say Sabre's worth $1 billion and they, you know, figure out how they can pay punitives from that. We were able to say on paper, they look like they're break even, but here is where they are, where they have money and assets. And it just worked out so perfectly with our expert. I mean, and every argument they made, we were able to kind of flip on its head. They made this argument that COVID took a huge toll on their ability to make money and they were barely able to make it. But yet we were able to establish that through COVID, they paid down a line of credit to the tune of like what, $30 million, Jamie? And they never saw a decrease in what they were making or what the CEOs were making or anything like that. So we were able to just kind of flip all that on their head. But it was with the through the effort of our expert too that helped us.
Brenna, getting back to the question you asked about this, the procedure of the trial, which is weird, right? So we said, okay, when you're setting punitive damages, there's three guideposts. I expect this is for anybody who doesn't. Three guideposts to set punitive damages, if you find that the plaintiff's entitled to them, are the act, the harm, the wealth of the defendants. So because it's not just the wealth, right? This trial, we had to show a brand new jury what the act was. Why was the act so bad? And what the harm was? What were the damages? And then the wealth. So we sent it to Judge Mung. We said, well, how are we going to do this? How are you planning on, because these cases typically are not bifurcated. They are usually done, like we all know, closings right after you find recklessness. Maybe you get a little discovery, right? And then a week later, the same jury comes back. So this is a brand new jury. We're saying, well, how the hell are we going to show this new jury that this act is worthy of a couple $1 million in punitives? And we said, well, are we going to bring the nurses back? Are we going to call them back? Are they going to sign? And then we know the defendants want to have them back up to soften the blow. Like to say, you told Attorney Anselin that you were reckless. Do you even know what that means? That was my worry. Well, Judge Munley, and rightfully so, said this jury is going to hear exactly what the first jury who found reckless indifference heard. So you will read back their deposition testimony. You can have your nurse back in, because the jury can just determine their credibility, how they look, what they sound like, what their emotions are, but you're not putting in new testimony. The only new testimony that's coming into this trial is the wealth of the defendants. So I think that was a blessing because it really made our jobs easier. I said, oh, thank God. Now we don't have to worry about how we're going to present the evidence. We're going to basically, we didn't have to read the transcript verbatim, the whole thing of the past witnesses. We were able to pick our parts. Did that. And I think that was boring, but very effective because the testimony was great. And we knew when the parts were good, we were able to inflect our voices and make it somewhat interesting. Where it became boring, of course, was having, imagine rereading your expert on damages and standard of care. It was brutal, but we had to do it. And that was the only way to do that. Where the case had some fireworks was the wealth, because we were, you know, showing the CEO's deposition and him saying, every dollar you make us pay is a dollar taken from the bedside, right?
Right, yeah.
And I said, well, okay, well, so you care about all your facilities, blah, blah, blah. I said, you're not going to be at the trial. Who's going to be there for Sabre? One of our regional managers. I said, what's his name? Jason. The last name escapes me, right? So that was, we were able to play with that to say, do they really care?
Right.
They don't even have someone they know the last name of that's in this courtroom. So that's kind of how the punitive damage only trial went.
What were the key arguments that, I mean, in addition to the wealth, so the wealth and the hypocrisy of this Sabre, the mom and pop shop is actually not a home. But what were the key arguments that you think resonated? Because I've heard a couple different punitive approaches, but it's a different type of argument model. So did you have any particular framework or argument that you used you thought was effective that people could use in their punitive trials?
Well, so I think look at the jury instruction, right? And the jury instruction is, and I think this is so crucial and it helped us so much, was, you know, an 8.0, I'm not going to put this up. I know we're a little tight on time now, but the idea is you may award punitive damages in order to punish the defendant for his or her conduct and to deter other defendants from similar conduct. So that to me is a huge thing in the nursing home world, because it makes it even bigger than Sabre and Greenridge. There's how many Sabres out there right now that are owning all these facilities. So the deterrence, I think, is huge. And then, as I said, those guideposts, the character of the act, the nature and extent of the harm, and then the wealth of the defendant. So what we did was, right from the start, and again, it's clumsy because this jury hasn't heard anything that the first jury heard. We said, look, there's already been a reckless indifference finding, and we kind of go through the facts and talk about the case. So you don't have to worry about that. But what does reckless indifference give you, the jurors, the opportunity to do? You now have an opportunity that most people will never get. And that is, you actually have the power to change some part of the nursing home industry over the next 4 days. If citizens want to do that, they have to write letters to senators. They have to stand in line. Maybe they have to rally. They may have to protest. You have the power over the next 4 days to actually effectuate change. And the reason you have the ability to do that is because another jury has already found that there's reckless indifference. So how can you do that? How can you send the message? Well, let's talk about the guideposts. You can consider the act, you can consider the harm, and you can consider the wealth. That made a nice framework for the case, because we were just kind of filling out the areas under each one of those guideposts. And so, like, the big things I thought that were crucial with the act, and this is something you don't get to do under normal compensatory. The act, first of all, arguing it's not an isolated incident, which they want you to believe. It's a pattern of conduct. And it's not just about this CNA. She's a wonderful person. The world needs people like her. But she was on an island, as were all the CNAs, because nobody listened to them, right? It was a pattern of doing things wrong over and over and over and over until somebody finally gets hurt. The act also that I think is a good part to really fill out is to talk about not just your client's injury, because hip fractures, we're numb to it, right? But we say the act, the art, the idea of dropping somebody, transferring them incorrectly because nobody changed their conduct. The next time, the next victim, another bad outcome, maybe that next person who falls doesn't fracture their hip. Maybe they die. Maybe they have a brain bleed. Maybe they're paralyzed. I thought that resonated somewhat, because now the jurors are thinking, oh, Jesus, it's not just about this hip fracture. That's one part of the case. How about if this conduct continues and my mom gets dropped and she's paralyzed? So I think the act, that's how we blew up the act and made that more than just this case. The harm spoke for itself, because the family was really good on talking about her pain and her suffering and everything she went through. And then the wealth, we focused on, I think we got the jury pissed off, because to come in and be a $50 million a year company and say we have nothing was preposterous. And we actually let an accountant stay on our jury panel. And they were glued into the numbers. And when we were showing the pockets of money that they could come up with to pay the money out, they were really buying that. And the thing we said was, they're not doing anything illegal. They're playing within the confines of the world that they're in. They're just masters at moving money to make it look like they have no money. And for them to come in front of you and say, we don't have money, every dollar we pay is dollar taken from the bedside. We said the reverse is true. The more money you make them pay, the more change at the bedside, right? They're gambling on you getting it wrong, just like they gambled on our patient, our client. Why do we know they're gambling on you guys getting it wrong? Where are they? They sent a corporate rep up. They don't even know who his last name is. So it's your call. You don't have to send the message. You don't have to give punitive damages. But if you don't award punitives, no message, no change, it's your choice. That's your responsibility. And I don't know. I think that resonated, because I think we empowered them.
Yeah, I love that whole idea of giving them the agency and autonomy. Like, this is up to you. I'm not going to tell you what to do, but these are your options. And here's what's going to happen if you go this way or if you go that way. Did you ultimately have, when you're talking about wealth, did you ever get down to like a bottom line number you could pin them down on? Or was it just this kind of amorphous number of numbers and you're suggesting it's this and they're suggesting it's zero or nothing?
We never had a number, but we did know, like I said, that they had the ability to pay. So there were a couple of things. There were like three pots that they had. They had the ability to pay down their credit line to the tune of 30 some million. They had, was it a $10 million liability, Jamie?
Yep.
That we couldn't tell the jury. It was actually a fine that they paid in a short span of time. So they had the cash to pay that. And then they had this big general sweep account that had tens of millions in it. That was kind of just out there. Those were the three areas we argued that they had money.
Well, there was one more. They also had distributed $26 million to the owners over the course of however many years. So we said, if you could do that, and the owners are a part of all this, you can infuse the money back in to pay this award.
And here's the thing. Juries aren't stupid. Once you paint this picture of this big corporation that owns 150 nursing homes, they know there's money there. Everybody knows that. I don't think you need to really even tease that out as well as we did. I mean, I think we did a good job with that, but juries aren't stupid. They know that. And so once we were able to show just these general pots that they had available to them and the ability to make these large payments, the jury knows they have money somewhere, right?
Yeah. And
Brennan, let me ask you a question, because I'm sick. You've interviewed so many people on this, and I've read David Ball's books on this one issue. And I didn't know whether or not to hit it, but I did end up mentioning it in the closing. Here's the question. You have to figure there's an underlying thought that jurors have that I don't want this estate. This is a lot of money to be going to the estate, right? So to address it, to say, I know you guys are probably thinking this, the money we're asking you for to be sending this message, that maybe that's a lot of money going to the estate. Do you address it? Or do you just let it go?
So, I mean, at different points in my career, I might have given you a different answer. But based off of what I've learned from some of these big data studies, there's a couple different groups out there that do these very large statistical analyses of cases. And then they're testing case after case. And from what I'm gathering, the motivator, the big motivator of money in cases is most often, well, in a situation like this, I should say, is going to be the punishment factor. And there, I don't think that the jury is going in your situation. I don't think it was one of those ones where they're probably giving it much thought of, oh, well, we don't want to give all this money to this estate, or what are they going to do with it? I would bet they probably thought very little of that. You know, and it's also, I think, so much of where do you focus your case? And I think the two of you, it sounds like, did a terrific job of that whole punitives case was all focused on the defense and the shell game and the money and all about the money. And even though you did bring in more of the testimony about the pain that this poor woman suffered for the remainder of her life, I would bet they were just focused on what's the right amount of money to deter, to prevent this from happening. And that's why I think, and you left it up to them. And you left it up to their imagination to think that conduct rewarded as conduct repeated. If you don't punish them, they're going to do it again. Right. And next time it could be way worse. And next time, you can't say this, but you can imply it, it could be your family member. And I think the way you focused on it is where you addressed it. And I personally, it doesn't sound like you focused too much on what's going to happen with the money in the state. You kept the focus on the defense. And I think that was the way to go. And that's at least what I would have done. And I think it sounds like you guys did a masterful job. Speaking of what it, so 300 was the compensatory award in the first phase of the trial. What did the jury do with the verdict and the punitives?
By the way, another jury that was out for 45 minutes,
yeah.
45 minutes in the first case, 45 minutes in the second case. And I thought that, believe it or not, I mean, I thought the defense lawyer did a very nice job in his closing. I really do think that he did. And I got done with my closing and I said to Kelly, I go, I'm concerned, because you may award punitive damages. You could technically have, well, then let's say zero.
Yeah.
So two people said zero, no award, and 10 averaged it out to 2.7 million.
Is that right?
Which I think, yeah. And what I think they did was, I'd imagine they wanted the grant, the full award to be 3 million. That's 300 from compensatory. They knew the compensatory. The judge ordered, and we fought against this hard, that this jury would know everything that the first jury knew, which was a compensatory verdict of 300. So they took, I think they took the 300 and added 27 to it to make it three. Talking to the jury after, there was a number of people that were at 5-6 million. They got, you know how this goes. They got leveled out and
average it out.
And, yeah, average it out. Got it down to 27.
But you, the jury was polled and two of the people said zero, and then the rest were some range of in the millions, I'm guessing.
Yeah, well, it was just 10 people unanimously at 27, and then two people were zeros. That's how our polling works. Like, do you agree with the jury? Raise your hand if you agree with the jury verdict. There was 10 of them, and it was two who didn't. We spoke to those two after. I didn't know if they just didn't agree with the number or not. They said, no, we wanted to give zero because we didn't think there were. And the one lady, and we took a shot at this, was in healthcare. She was a retired nurse. And we said, maybe she looked good. Like, she answered questions good. She had a good personality. And I said, why did you give zero? And she said, it doesn't matter. There won't be change no matter what.
Oh,
so
wow.
I thought that'd be, I didn't want to give money to the estate.
Back to your question a second ago, I think you have to focus on the punishment aspect, the prevention, the deterrence, and so forth, because of the fact that, especially if they heard they already got money, they already got $300,000 for a 92-year-old yep. woman, there's going to be a lot of cynical folks out there that are going to, you already got enough, and now you're coming back. And then I think sometimes anywhere out these, the lawyers are trying to swoop in with these punitive damages and send a message type of stuff. Because I've encountered that in focus groups before, that I've had people literally say, oh, don't give me this, send a message stuff again. But again, it just depends on the facts of the case. And it sounds, again, like you really did it perfectly, because those two people show it's not just a slam dunk to get that punitive damage. You think everyone just thinks, oh, it's like you walk into the bank and cash in a check. You very easily could have gotten zero or much lower. So I think that's an amazing. I mean, again, I'm reading that trial thing. 92-year-old woman with a hip fracture dies of unrelated causes a couple years later. And the end result is $3 million or 2.7 punitive. I mean, unbelievable what you two did in that case. So it's truly insanely amazing. Last question, selfishly, do either of you have like your opening or closing? Do you have any of the transcripts that you could share that if anybody listens is interested could read over? Because I know I'd love to see how you structured this. I know, Jamie, we didn't get to, but you have a bunch of slides and so forth that I would love to look at if there's any way you guys could share them.
Yeah, I have an opening. So Kelly did the opening in the compensatory case. I did the closing in that. And then in the punitive, I did the opening and the closing. But so we have four, and they were all PowerPoints. So we'd be happy to send those, happy to send any transcripts. In fact, after this, because we're part of the AJ nursing home group, we actually developed a little Sabre community, a Sabre committee with like 10 nursing home lawyers, because Sabre is all over the place. They have 25 facilities in North Carolina. And they've all, real quick, plugged AAJ, PAJ, why you belong to these places. If it wasn't for AAJ and getting the transcripts on the ones they had done already from the CFO from 2 years before our case, I would have had no idea where to go with the CFO and the CEO's deposition. Because they really, I mean, there's some great nursing home lawyers in our country and through AAJ. And we became friendly with some people down in North Carolina who filleted these guys a bunch of years ago on a similar punitive type of thing. Yeah, we got their transcripts, and that paved the way for those depositions. But anyway, we developed this little Sabre committee of like 10 of us, and we share lots of stuff on them because their model is play every case like it's going to trial and go very tough. And it's a numbers game for them. And they think they're going to weed out people who kind of dabble in nursing home work. I don't know, maybe working, but we'll see on this one.
For the nursing home practitioners listening, can they reach out to you to get in the Sabre listserv? Well, that's awesome.
Yes.
Well, again, thank you both so much for your time. I know it's the week of the hangover week between Christmas and New Year's. I appreciate you both making the time. You can go read more about Kelly and Jamie at angelonelaw.com. And if you guys could send me any of those materials, I know I'd love it. And I know anybody listening is probably a junkie for trial law, would love to go through it. So we'd really appreciate it. And just thank you both so much for your time. Congratulations, a well-earned victory, and excited for both of you.
Thanks, Brennan.
Thanks, Brennan.
Thanks for tuning in to Trial and Medical Error. We hope our discussions have equipped you with actionable insights to lift your clients above the hurdles of medical malpractice litigation. Ready to refer or collaborate on MedMal in catastrophic injury cases? Visit our attorney referral page at pamedmal.com/refer. See you in the next episode.